more powerful. And that's a huge jump from just 5 years ago when only 19% thought unions were gaining strength. And you can see what's behind the shift. This summer alone, we saw pilots win big raises. UPS drivers got what the Teamsters calls the most lucrative contract in UPS history. And of course, the Biden administration is happy about this. Workers are gaining not only historic raises, but also big quality of life improvements. Here's Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu.
I think that is continuing to inspire, you know, what people have called like a hot labor summer, right? You know, workers standing up. And the more we see that, I think the more we will see the benefits of real worker power.
Hot labor summer.
Yeah. We should point out, though, that now is the perfect time for unions to be putting up big demands because these companies have been enjoying record profits. And how long this lasts is unclear.
Okay. On that note, we should bring in Scott here and talk about the economy. How are unions feeling about this current moment in the economy?
Yeah, I think unions do feel like, if not now, when? As Andrea says, they've watched companies rack up big profits. We've also got very low unemployment, which makes it hard for companies to replace striking workers. And for the moment, of course, unions do enjoy strong public support. They also have a friendly administration in the White House right now. Vice President Harris said last week, unions help the middle class and the economy overall.
When union workers bargain for higher pay, it increases pressure on non-union companies to raise pay as well, to stay competitive in the labor market.
That said, there are limits to how much help the White House can be. The administration has taken steps to boost union participation in public works projects, for example, but it has gotten nowhere with unions' biggest priority, which is legislation that would make it easier for private sector workers to organize.
Yeah, I mean, we're in an economy where 9 out of 10 workers don't belong to a union. What kind of leverage do they have?
Yeah, the best thing those workers have going for them is the strong job market. Unemployment did tick up a little bit last month, but it's still very low. Employers added another 187,000 jobs in August. Competition for workers has been pushing up wages, especially for those at the bottom of the income ladder. All of that is good, but it's no match for the power of collective bargaining. You know, a report from the Treasury Department last week said, on average, unionized workers earn 10 to 15% more than their non-union counterparts. They also enjoy better benefits and tend to see smaller racial and gender pay gaps.
So, Andrea, one of the high-profile job actions this summer is that ongoing strike by actors and writers. How does this movie end?
Well, the last Hollywood writer strike in 2007 lasted 100 days, and we're already past that.
Yeah.
What's complicating things is it's not just about wages. It's about job security and changing times. And we're seeing that in Detroit as well. You know, these are industries going through major shifts to streaming services, their electric vehicles, the adoption of AI. Workers want a say in how these changes are going to be made. And employers, on the other hand, feel like there's a lot of uncertainty and they want to preserve their flexibility.
NPR's Andrea Hsu and Scott Horsley, thank you both.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Torrential rains put a serious damper on the Burning Man festival this year. Tens of thousands of revelers are stranded in the Nevada desert after heavy rainfall turned the annual week-long arts and countercultural event into a mud fest. Authorities are also confirming one death, which is under investigation.
It's Daniel Vandenbark's second Burning Man, and he says unexpected weather is just part of the experience.
I was here for the crazy heat, and now I'm here for the crazy rain, wind, and mud.
Vandenbark, who's from Los Angeles, compared the wet soil in the Nevada desert to mixing concrete.
It starts to get wet, and it just gets sticky. It's a really unique experience. It sticks to your shoes. It sticks to your feet. It's very difficult to get off. You can't ride a bike on it. You can't really drive on it. It just, whatever it touches, it sticks on.
The festival grounds were hit by over half an inch of rain on Friday night. Organizers closed access into and out of the temporary site for the remainder of the event, which officially ends today.
29-year-old Mimi Doe from Los Angeles was pitching in by frying up some bacon.
Seeing everybody kind of like doing something, I was like, well, I'm not going to be in my tent all day and just like, you know, mope around. So I decided to just like, yeah, make some food. It really encouraged me to like, you know what, like, let's be a part of this and help everyone out.
And even though her first Burning Man didn't exactly turn out as she hoped, Doe is certain that she will be back.
I love the people here. I love the community.
It's the third Burning Man for Denver resident Gordon Graham. He agrees the festival's sense of community sets it apart.
I was not alerted of the rain. That was not in the brochure. But helping out your neighbors and being here for everybody, that was in the brochure. We know that. And I think everyone's really able to do that and excited to do that.
For 52-year-old Zaki Rubinstein, the whole situation is really a metaphor for life.
There are unexpected events, and you have to figure out how to navigate them and roll with it.
The first-time attendee said being stuck in the desert will make her grateful for the little things.
Well, I'm really, really going to appreciate bathrooms, and mine in particular. You know, when you live without them, you realize, oh, modern plumbing, that is a marvel.
Yeah, this is why I don't camp. With more rain and thunderstorms drenching the festival area yesterday, organizers have asked attendees to conserve water and food and shelter in place for now. But there is one sliver of good news. A social media account associated with the Burning Man Project's website says the traditional climax of the festival, the burning of a giant man-like structure, will happen tonight. For this next story, we go to Argentina, where our movie critic Bob Mandello spends a lot of time with his relatives. He was recently checking out not the art of cinema, but an art that Bob calls delicious.
Everyone you meet in Buenos Aires is a fierce partisan when it comes to football, meaning soccer, cafes, and heladerias, ice cream parlors, which in the summer seem nearly as common as cafes. I'm at Heladería Cadore in the theater district, talking to owner Gabriel Fama, whose uncle started Cadore at this same location back in 1957. Fama is understandably proud of his ice cream, made fresh daily, as his uncle instructed, right in the store.
El auténtico helado artesanal.
And he's happy to wax eloquent on the richness of the flavor, pistachio, cardamom, hibiscus, and of course, chocolate. We're talking as one of his employees uses what could almost be a canoe paddle to stir quarts of creamy dark chocolate and thick caramel-like dulce de leche into a vat where spiraling metal blades mix them with air into an almost taffy-like chocolate mousse base. It is small batch, handmade daily, and it's every bit as good as Fama thinks it is. But I'm fixated on something else about his ice cream, the way it sits in a cone. It's a work of art. The folks behind the counter sculpt the ice cream into what looks like a 6-inch-high inverted cone atop the waffle cone. If this were soft serve or custard, that'd be easy. But this is real ice cream, rich and solid, sometimes with nuts or chocolate chunks or bits of figs. So it's not malleable the same way. He shows me how they do it. It starts the way it does in the U.S. You scoop up a glob of ice cream and plop it atop a cone. But sculpting these towers requires a lot of wrist action. The scoops aren't cupped, so they don't produce globes of ice cream. They're flat like pancake flippers or spatulas. So his employees create the shape of the inverted cone on the spatula. And then they sort of back it onto the waffle cone atop the lower layer. A flick of the wrist at the end, it's like a dance move, separates the spatula and leaves a tower. It's gorgeous. And it's just how they do it in Buenos Aires. Everywhere, not just at Cadore, you don't get round scoops here. Fama, for whom all of this is second nature, thinks I'm making too much of appearances. He says, as with a beautiful woman or a handsome man,
una linda mujer, un lindo hombre,
you can put on your best clothes, best perfume, but ultimately it comes down to the person. With ice cream, he says, it's the same.
El helado es lo mismo.
You can make it aesthetically pleasing, but then there's a moment when it's just you alone with the ice cream.
Y el helado a solas.
In that moment,
ice.
The ice cream has to be special. I could certainly vouch for his in Buenos Aires and gaining pounds just by being here. I'm Bob Mandela.
Ice cream, and for the first time, we were together without a spat. Friendly, he was so friendly. That isn't like him. I'm simply stunned.
This is NPR News.
Oh, man, ice cream on a really hot Labor Day holiday sounds perfect, doesn't it? This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Alex Crowe, trying to survive the heat with you today. We're looking at temperatures possibly in the 90s across the state. So, yeah, I would say it's a perfect day for some ice cream. Coming up here on the program, what would you do if you woke up in the middle of the night and all of a sudden the earth was shaking? It's not like you were in a place where you were expecting an earthquake to hit right here in the Midwest. We'll talk about that coming up in just a bit on WPR.
There was a time when subprime meant cheap steak and inflation worries were limited to the air pressure in your car tires. Things are a little more complicated now, but understanding the issues doesn't have to be. Marketplace helps you decode the economic news that matters and leaves the clutter to the other guys. It's the business show for the rest of us.
Join us for Marketplace tonight and each weeknight at 6:30, right after All Things Considered here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from Reynolds Residential Moving, dedicated to providing quality household moving and storage services throughout Wisconsin and North America. Reynolds is proud to be a WPR Business Cornerstone sponsor.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha Community Foundation is accepting applications from nonprofits for grant proposals in several categories. The application deadline is September 25th. More information is available on the foundation's website, kenoshafoundation.org.
On Wisconsin Public Radio, in weather, highs in the 90s across many parts of the state today. Heat index values could hit triple digits in the south. Tomorrow, that heat and humidity is expected to remain once again. But the good news, a line of storms expected to move in, especially around western Wisconsin tomorrow. That'll cool things off for the rest of the week. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features with My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3. The Portokalis family is headed to Greece. From director Nia Vardalos and featuring the original cast, only in theaters September 8th. From Workday, an enterprise management cloud focused on providing organizations with a system to continuously plan for all what-if scenarios. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. From Fisher Investments, Fisher Investments' team of specialists tailor portfolios to each client's long-term goals. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investments in securities involve the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Daniel Estrin. A music legend gets a fresh look in the documentary Little Richard, I Am Everything, premiering tonight on CNN. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans says the film excels by focusing on the star's roots in and struggle with his connection to queer culture.
Well, long tall, Sally, she's a beautiful species guy. Everything that Uncle John needs, oh baby.
As a performer and personality, Little Richard rarely held back.
Let it all hang out with the beautiful Little Richard from down in Macon, Georgia.
Especially when it came to the subject of his accomplishments and appeal.
I want you all to know that I am the Bronze Liberace. Shut up!
But director Lisa Cortez's expansive film asks a poignant question about a pioneering performer often called the architect of rock and roll. It's best phrased here by Juilliard School ethnomusicologist Ferdera Hadley.
What would it do to the American mythology of rock music to say that its pioneers were black queer people?
For music fans, the film is a poignant reminder of just how good Little Richard was, especially in the 1950s and 60s. We see him captivate crowds with his percussive piano style and preacher's swagger, sweating through loads of pancake makeup with his pencil-thin mustache and serious pompadour hairstyle.
Lucy, you won't do your sister's will.
We see his influence on everyone from Prince to the Beatles, from interviews with celebrities like Mick Jagger, Billy Porter, and John Waters. Waters says as a youth, he even stole a record of Little Richard's hit, Lucille.
The first songs that you love that your parents hate is the beginning of the soundtrack of your life. And in my case, it was most definitely Lucille.
Born Richard Pennyman in Macon, Georgia in 1932, Little Richard was openly gay from a young age, kicked out of his family home by a father who expected him to be more masculine. Performing on the Chitlin circuit of black-centered clubs through the South, he worked early shows singing in drag, later learning his performing style and piano playing from other black gay performers at the time, Billy Wright and Esquerita. And when one of his early recording sessions wasn't going well, he went to a nearby bar to blow off steam. He jumped on a piano there and played a song about sex. For the film, keyboardist and singer Corey Henry recreates that moment. The song, with sanitized lyrics of course, became Little Richard's first big hit. The film also delves into periods when he became devoutly religious, denouncing his life as a gay man and his success in rock and roll. He saw those triumphs as encouraging the devil, but his baby boomer fans saw them as a liberation from the strict mores of their parents. Here, one expert describes Little Richard singing gospel on the Muscular Dystrophy Association telethon in 1983.
When I hear his passionate singing at this time, it's hard to tell how much is running towards God versus running away from himself.
Little Richard died in 2020 at age 87. The film Little Richard, I Am Everything is a masterpiece and worthy tribute. It traces how the genre's earliest expressions of rock and roll spirit were rooted in both queer culture in general and his specific experiences as a gender-bending gay man. I'm Eric Deggans.
Earthquakes, they're kind of part of life on the West Coast. In Ohio, not so much. But that's exactly where there's been a whole lot of shaking going on, at least for a few minutes. The state's experienced several in the past year, IdeaStream Public Media's Abigail Botar reports.
It was late Sunday night, about 11 p.m. on August 27th, and Margaret Bushman was finishing a good book when something odd happened.
The couch shook, and the whole kind of house was shaking, but it lasted about that long. And I heard this rumbling sound that at first I thought was my dryer, and then I said, no, my dryer's not that loud in my living room.
Bushman lives in Madison, Ohio, along the shores of Lake Erie, northeast of Cleveland. She realized quickly that what she felt was an earthquake, not one that threw her house out of disarray or caused harm, but it was noticeable, clocking in with a magnitude of 3.6.
I mean, you can have an earthquake this large pretty much anywhere.
Paul Earle is a seismologist with the United States Geological Survey.
I mean, this is not a huge earthquake. It does not take a huge fault to generate an earthquake of this size.
What Northeast Ohio has is a grouping of faults, faults that are miles below Lake Erie and underground in the bedrock. And earthquakes are not uncommon here. Last month, there were 11 quakes in Ohio, 5 of them in this Lake County region. And the one in late August, although minor by earthquake standards, was the largest by far. Vicky Wyatt lives in Geneva, Ohio, an area also affected. She says the sound of the earthquake gave her a clue that this was bigger than normal.
We had that rumbling, like it was getting a little louder. You could hear it and kind of feel it before it hit.
Two aftershocks were recorded after the quake. Seismologist Earl says it's common for one earthquake to trigger others.
It's more like popcorn going off where you have a kernel explodes and then a bunch of kernels explode and then it stops for, calms down for a while and so forth and so on. So it's not surprising to see a variation in the number of earthquakes with time.
In Ohio, that's meant a lot of low-level tremors, which typically cause little, if any, damage. Joe Busher, the head of the Lake County Emergency Management Agency, says that was the case for this latest quake in Northeast Ohio.
That's because of strong building codes and the enforcement of those codes throughout the county, that our structures all held up well during that event.
Vicky Wyatt agrees. She says nothing was damaged in her home, and she feels prepared for any future Ohio earthquakes that may come.
We can be pretty self-sufficient. We grow a garden and hunt and fish. We always have stuff, and we have a generator.
She's just hoping she doesn't have to use it anytime soon, even though she lives in a seismically active region. For NPR News, I'm Abigail Botar in Lake County, Ohio.
This is NPR News.
Ukraine's top counterintelligence official has been fighting Russian hackers for years, including during the ongoing counteroffensive.
New doctrines will be written and adopted according to what has happened here in Ukraine.
An exclusive inside look at Ukraine's cyber war with Russia on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30, today on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Good morning. Glad you're with us for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Alex Crow on this Labor Day Monday. It's 8:29. News from NPR and WPR on the way.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Ukraine's defense minister is stepping down a day after the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said he would remove Oleksiy Reznikov from the job. Zelensky says new military approaches are needed as Russia's invasion of Ukraine moves through its 19th month. Turkey's president is in southern Russia today. Recep Tayyip Erdogan is trying to convince Russian President Vladimir Putin to rejoin the UN deal that allows safe passage for ships hauling grain from Ukraine's ports along the Black Sea. Putin withdrew Moscow from that agreement in July, saying his country's interests were not being met. Ahead of the talks in Sochi, Russian forces have been striking at Ukraine's ports along the Danube River. NPR's Brian Mann has more.
Russian drones struck Izmail for more than 3 hours early Monday, causing what regional governor Oleh Kiper described as widespread infrastructure damage. Ukrainian air defenses knocked out 17 drones, but others reportedly hit their targets, setting several buildings on fire. Russia has largely choked off shipments from Ukraine's big port on the Black Sea in Odessa. Ukraine has tried to shift cargo traffic to ports on the Danube River. Moscow has used repeated missile and drone strikes to cripple that effort. In this latest attack, warehouses and other buildings were damaged, but there were no reports of casualties.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. A new mental health walk-in clinic for children will open in Kenosha later this year. Evan Casey has more.
Therapists and social workers at the Children's Wisconsin Clinic in Kenosha will provide immediate mental health support for children and teens ages 5 to 18. Patients can receive therapy sessions, safety risk assessments, and referrals for ongoing care. It's the second such clinic to open in the state in the last 2 years. Amy Herbst is a vice president of mental and behavioral health at Children's Wisconsin. She says there's a need for clinics that offer same-day mental health services.
They've always been needed, but it has been something that's not typically available to kids and families in the state of Wisconsin and many places across the United States.
A $3 million donation from Kohl's will help the hospital open two more clinics in the state. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Police in the Milwaukee suburb of Whitefish Bay are investigating after more than 70 flyers containing and promoting hate speech were littered throughout the village. WISN-TV reports the flyers also contained links to a website which promoted white supremacy, displayed videos with Nazi imagery, and used racist and anti-Semitic language. The village's president wrote online that he was, quote, deeply saddened that our community was targeted by individuals seeking attention for their hateful ideology, end quote. Police say they're still looking into the incident. Red flag warnings have expired, but the fire danger remains high across most of Wisconsin. The Department of Natural Resources issued red flag warnings for many south central and southwestern Wisconsin counties yesterday due to a combination of high winds, high temperatures, and already dry conditions on the ground. Despite the warnings expiring overnight, the National Weather Service has still issued a special statement due to high fire danger. The DNR is asking everyone to avoid outdoor burning until things cool back down. Burn permits have also been suspended in several counties. WISC-TV in Madison also reports that the DNR responded to and extinguished 15 wildfires just last week. Highs expected to reach the 90s in many parts of the state today as that heat continues. Heat index values approaching the triple digits. It's expected to stay that way tomorrow before things start to cool back down around midweek. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Data IQ, a platform for everyday AI, dedicated to helping teams move beyond the lab to build generative AI applications at enterprise scale. DATAIKU.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Z-Quil Pure Z's gummies, designed with melatonin for occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep naturally. Learn more at ZQuil.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington. Since taking office, President Biden has pledged to deliver justice to communities who believe they are taking the brunt of environmental pollution. Many in Louisiana who live in a region known as Cancer Alley had placed their hopes in that promise. But the abrupt closure of a high-profile investigation into one of the country's largest toxic hotspots has advocates questioning whether Biden is living up to his commitment. To talk about this, Hallie Parker from member station WWNO is joining us. Hi, Hallie.
Hi, Layla.
So before we get into your reporting, let's talk about what and where Cancer Alley is.
Certainly. So Cancer Alley is actually a nickname for this big swath of Louisiana. The region stretches from New Orleans through Baton Rouge along the Mississippi River, and it's home to more than 150 industrial plants. And residents there face some of the highest cancer and health risks in the nation due to the air pollution. And studies have actually shown it's worse for Black residents. They're exposed to levels of air pollution up to 21 times higher than their white neighbors.
Wow. So what was at the center of this EPA investigation?
The investigation was looking at a lot of different things, but at its core, the EPA was investigating whether Louisiana's environmental regulator, the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, had allowed companies to build and pollute in a way that had caused disproportionate harm to these Black communities. And notably, you know, it was one of the first times the EPA was linking environmental harm to civil rights violations. And it was also the first time that the EPA had stepped in to look at what residents and environmental advocates in the area had been complaining about for decades.
So from what you're describing, this investigation could have had historic consequences. But then the EPA's inquiry abruptly closes in June. But you didn't stop looking into it, right, Hallie? You dug into why it was shut down. So what caught your attention?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was just so shocking that the EPA, out of the blue, shut it all down. It blindsided everyone, you know, even the people involved in this case. So I decided to FOIA the state to see what might turn up. And we ended up getting the last version of an agreement that the EPA and the state had spent months negotiating. And obviously, you know, I'm not a lawyer. So I looked at that agreement with a legal expert, Monique Hardin, and she works for the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice. She was actually astonished by how much the agreement could have changed the situation in Louisiana if regulators hadn't walked away. It would have required Louisiana's regulators to go beyond just conducting studies and actually make decisions on permits if they reinforced racial disparities, which could include even denying them. And it was the sort of resolution environmental advocates dreamed of.
But then it didn't come to fruition. Suddenly, this EPA case is shut down. So how are people living in Cancer Alley feeling now that they know all this?
We still don't have a full picture of everything, like why the EPA closed the case, and that's left residents with a lot of questions. Overwhelmingly, there's this feeling of disappointment. I recently spoke with Robert Taylor. He was one of the complainants that spurred the investigation in the first place. He lives in Reserve, this small community in the middle of Louisiana's Chemical Corridor, and leads a group of residents called the Concerned Citizens of St. John. And he told me he was in denial at first. He felt abandoned, like a lot of other residents.
They just cut tail and ran. I'm still flabbergasted by that.
But Taylor and others I've spoken to have made clear that they're not giving up on their fights. They just don't feel as confident that this new EPA will live up to all of its promises.
Hallie Parker is a reporter for member station WWNO in New Orleans. Thanks for this reporting, Hallie.
Thank you.
Early this morning, four astronauts splashed down off the coast of Florida after 6 months on the International Space Station. One of them is from the United Arab Emirates. Only a few people from the Middle East have gone to space, and his mission is being hailed as a milestone for the region. NPR's Aya Batraoui joins us now from Dubai. Hi, Aya.
Hey, Daniel.
Hey, so tell us about this astronaut.
So Sultan Al-Niadi, he's an engineer with a PhD who spent 20 years in the military. And at 42, he's also a father of six. So I can only imagine what the mother of his kids felt like all that time with those kids on her own. But this is a tribal, tight-knit society, and they really rally around each other and their own. And his mission, it's being seen as a historic moment of pride for this country and really for the region. And you can sense the excitement on social media, online, in the local press, and the UAE's leadership. I mean, they have really thrown their support behind him, ensuring he gets the publicity and the kind of attention they feel is worthy of this mission. And although he is the second astronaut from the UAE to go to space, it's by far the longest mission by an Arab astronaut, decades after a Saudi prince made history as the first person from this region to go to space. Let's listen to a clip from Sultan Al Niyadi just a few days ago before leaving the ISS.
It was really amazing, especially for my region. I come from a place where space flights, human space flights, were stopped for more than 30 years. And I felt that I'm responsible, obligated to show what's happening on board the station. I think it's a small boost towards spreading the enthusiasm in our region.
Yeah, very cool. So he spent 6 months in space. What are some of the moments that stood out from his time?
Well, look, he's had a really very savvy social media presence. He's been posting all these very cool pictures from the ISS, and he's been posting and sharing all his captions in English and in Arabic, making it very accessible to people from this region. He was also up there during Ramadan and shared a photo of the crescent moon, which marks the start of the Muslim holy month. So this, I think, really helped people connect with his, you know, mission and see themselves in his images. But there's also other highlights, like he took part in something like 200 experiments while he was up there, and he donned that big puffy white astronaut suit and made a spacewalk outside the ISS. So that also marks the first time for an Arab astronaut to do that. But another major highlight was he was visited aboard the ISS in May for a few days by two Saudi astronauts, including the first ever Arab woman astronaut to go to space.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture now that he took of Jerusalem, where I am, and it's just ethereal. I've never seen Jerusalem like that. It's beautiful. So, Aya, what is the UAE up to? It's such a small country. What is it trying to do in space?
So if we take a step back, this part of the world, North Africa, the Middle East, the Near East, for hundreds of years until around the 13th century, they were pioneers in the fields of medicine and science in what's known as the Islamic Golden Age. And that is a point of pride included in local textbooks and children's books. But yeah, this is a very young and small country. It's just around 50 years old with the local population of just over 1 million people. But they've been very strategic about how they deploy their oil and gas wealth, including by building a space program, by partnering with countries that have very advanced space programs like the U.S., Russia, South Korea, and Japan. They currently have a satellite orbiting Mars and examining its atmosphere, and they plan to send another rover to the moon after the first try failed. But I think the message here is clear. If you can dream it, we're game to try, and the UAE's leaders insist nothing is impossible.
All right, that's NPR's Aya Batraoui in Dubai. Thank you, Aya.
Thanks, Daniel.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WPR. Good morning. I'm Alex Crow here rounding out the summer with you on this Labor Day Monday. It's about 8:42 now on this Monday. Still plenty of stuff to come here at the program. Maybe you're hitting a beach this weekend to try and cool off. In southern France, there's a new app that's being rolled out for people who are at the beach and subject to unwanted attention and harassment. That new app will summon police officers right away. We'll hear about it coming up in just a few minutes on Wisconsin Public Radio.
By supporting WPR, you ensure your friends and neighbors have access to award-winning reporting and essential information on air and online. You can help keep these valuable resources available for your community for years to come by including a gift to WPR in your will. Talk to your financial advisor and visit WPRlegacy.org.
Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar. Committed to assisting business owners in becoming more energy independent and relying less on utility providers. Information is at allenergysolar.com/learn.
Support comes from Offsite, a managed information technology provider focused on cybersecurity and system reliability. Offsite's 24/7 Network Operations Center is staffed by their team of Wisconsin-based engineers. Visit off-site.com/radio.
Here's a look at what's happening in news. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he'll be replacing the country's defense minister. This is the biggest shakeup in Ukraine's government since Russia invaded their country. Tens of thousands of people were stranded in the Nevada desert over the weekend when nearly an inch of rain fell on partygoers at Burning Man. Roads into and out of the festival were closed to vehicles, leaving many people to walk miles through the mud on foot to get out. Madison police are asking people to remain vigilant after a university student was attacked over the weekend. The victim was taken to the hospital for treatment of serious injuries. So far, no arrests have been made. And the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is still asking people to avoid burning outdoors because of the elevated risk of wildfires. Dry conditions on the ground combined with record-breaking temperatures led to red flag warnings being issued yesterday. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dementia Society of America, committed to helping support brain health and the millions of Americans experiencing the syndrome known as dementia. Learn more at 1-800-DEMENTIA.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Daniel Estrin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Can an app help fight sexual harassment on public beaches? The southern French city of Marseille thinks so. Reporter Rebecca Rossman went to find out more.
It's one of those crowded summer days at the Catalan beach in central Marseille. But big crowds can sometimes breed tense situations. Take 28-year-old Axelle Groot, who came here to tan with her friend.
I just had, like, untied my top, but I wasn't even doing, like, any topless tanning. We're together, so two girls.
It took only a matter of seconds before she started being harassed by a group of 14-year-old boys.
And they were like, oh, we can see your we can see your like, fix it, fix your top.
From unwanted advances to unsolicited comments about her body, Glute says she has experienced various forms of sexual harassment at the beach.
I mean, it's a daily thing, I think. I mean, personally, I choose not to react most of the time because it's too dangerous.
Except now, there's an app for that. It's called Safer Plage, or Safer Beach. After a successful pilot experiment last summer, it's now being used on four beaches across the city. Users anonymously download the app with a smartphone. If a situation occurs, they can then select between three options, says Justine Noël with the nonprofit Oron, which is behind the project.
Je suis gênée, je suis harcelée, ou je suis en danger.
I'm being bothered, I'm being harassed, or I'm in danger. The app then sends out a notification to a trained mediator employed by the app to patrol the beaches and intervene when necessary.
Et ensuite, ils cliquent sur cette notification et tout de suite,
and then they click on the notification, she says, using the app's geolocation tool to spot victims. And they can also communicate with them directly using a chat function. The city of Marseille has put more than $125,000 into training 16 mediators who are taught how to intervene in situations ranging from excessive flirtation to domestic violence. Elias Bellocini manages the team of mediators. He says, for example, they recently dealt with a man who was catcalling a woman while she was sunbathing.
Ce qu'on a fait, c'est qu'on a parlé avec la victime.
First, we talked to the victim, he says, and then moved on to the perpetrator about the inappropriateness of his advances. In fact, catcalling isn't just inappropriate in France. In 2018, harassment in public spaces was ruled illegal. Fines can be more than $4,000. Activists have applauded that law for acting as a deterrent, and Justine Noël believes apps like hers are having a similar effect in stopping would-be harassers. The beach can be a very vulnerable place, she says, especially for women. The goal of the app is to help them defend themselves a bit more easily. But getting people to use the app has been a challenge. Noel says that while more than 900 people downloaded the app in the space of just 1 month this summer, there have been less than 5 alerts made in that same period. Back at the beach, I ask Axelle Groot if she would ever consider using an app like Safer Plage, to which she says, it's complicated.
So, I mean, I would feel kind of like a fool just like pressing a button and waiting for someone to show up and be like, oh, he was dressed like this and he looked like that. So it's just too late, and I think it's easier to just move on from that.
Justine Noël agrees that it can be hard to have that reflex in the moment, but she wants people to know that just moving on doesn't have to be the only solution. For NPR News, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Marseille.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WPR. Good morning. Happy Labor Day. I'm Alex. Happy Labor Day. Man, mixing up my words there. Happy Labor Day. I'm glad you're with us for Morning Edition on WPR. Well, coming up here on the program, an interesting story about giant trolls made out of recycled wood. Yes, you heard me right. And they're turning up in the Pacific Northwest after appearing all over the world. We'll hear that fun story in just a few minutes here on Morning Edition on WPR.
On Saturday morning, September 9th at 11:15, join us for the WGTD Radio Theater's live broadcast of The Cane Shadow, The Library Mystery. Broadcasting from the Kenosha Southwest Neighborhood Library, the Radio Theater, Saturday morning, September 9th at 11:15.
Quest, visit WPR.org.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. At 8:50, quick check of sports. The Milwaukee Brewers lost to the Philadelphia Phillies yesterday. The Chicago Cubs got a win. Brewers are 3.5 games up over the Cubs now for lead of the division. The Crew will take on the Pirates in Pittsburgh tonight with first pitch set for 5:35. The Badgers are 1-0 to start the year. They beat Buffalo yesterday. They will take on Washington State this Saturday night. And at the U.S. Open, it was Coco Gauff getting the win over Caroline Wozniacki yesterday. Gauff is now on to the quarterfinal. In weather, we'll see another hot day across Wisconsin today. Highs in the 90s and heat index values approaching triple digits. Could be record-breaking heat for Labor Day in some parts of the state. Tomorrow, more heat and humidity expected, but the good news, temperatures are expected to cool back down by around midweek. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Daniel Estrin. Now a story about trolls. Not the kind you find on the internet. Not exactly what you would find under a bridge in a fairy tale. You might find these trolls in New Jersey, Seattle, Puerto Rico, or South Korea. Giant trolls by the Danish artist Thomas Dambo. They've been called magical and otherworldly, and they're made out of recycled wood. And now he is building new trolls throughout the Pacific Northwest. Here is NPR's Elizabeth Blair.
In the woods at the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, a small army of, let's call them Geppettos and hoodies, are building a giant.
Pete, you think Scott could cut some?
Perched on scaffolding, using jigsaws and screw guns, they're making the giant troll's skin by fastening hundreds of pieces of wood onto a huge interior frame. The troll's feet alone are almost as tall as I am. Artist Thomas Dambo designed 5 trolls for the garden's more than 300 acres.
And then I always look for locations that has a little bit of different feelings. So one that's close to the water and one that's deep in the woods and one that's like next to the lake and one that's like down and up and in and out. So like to try and give people a good experience when they then walk around in the forest and find my art, because it's not really only about my art, it's also a lot about that experience you get when you walk around in nature and in the forest.
Dambo also wants to show people what you can do with trash. He says most of the recycled wood he uses comes from thrown-out shipping pallets, which he finds all over the world.
You can just get all the pallets you want. You can just go down the interstate and then look at some big factory, and then you can just go and ring their doorbell, and then they'll have 500 pallets out the back that you can have. And there's so many, and they'll just lay there and rot, or they'll get burned or something, so... Like, so for me, though, they're like a nice medium to work to make art in, because I'm not creating any trash. I'm just using other people's trash and then rearranging it a little bit.
Rearranging is an understatement. Dambo's trolls are not just huge. They're sculptures designed with so much imagination and whimsy, they've become social media stars. One lounges with his hands behind his head. Another uses a car for an armrest. Dambo gives them names like Sneaky Socks and Leo the Enlightened.
I like to think that my trolls are like alive, and now I probably sound a little bit crazy.
This fairy tale does have its villains. In 2018, Dambo made a troll for an arts festival in Breckenridge, Colorado. At about 15 feet high, Isaac Hartstone had a gentle smile on his face as he stacked rocks on the side of a hiking trail. Dambo says Isaac was inspired by the region's history of breaking up the ground to mine for gold.
And then the story talks about that Isaac Hartstone is trying to build a new little mountain because he's sad the other mountain has been broken down. And so I made a little story about this.
There was so much excitement around just how cool he was and how well he actually fit into our scenery and our environment.
But, says Haley Littleton, a spokesperson for the town of Breckenridge, Isaac Hartstone's popularity became a problem.
We essentially had thousands of visitors a day on some of our busy weekends coming up there. And, really having an issue with parking and trash.
Neighbors complained. In winter, people slipped on the ice going to see the troll. Dambo was following the drama from Denmark.
Of course, I don't want people to get hurt, but in Denmark, it's we have another view on insurance and liability. So in Denmark, if you hike a mountain in the middle of winter, it's your own fault if it's slippery and you just fall on the ice.
That's not how it works in the U.S. Eventually, the town council of Breckenridge voted. Isaac Hartstone had to go.
I get a phone call in the middle of the night saying, now they're going to take down the sculpture. And then I'm like, okay, well, that's really a shame. And they're like, we can find a new place for it. But we have to take it down now because there's an uprising and people are protesting that they're taking down the sculpture. Then I'm like, it's out of my hands. I can't do anything.
To avoid an outcry, the town kept the day of Isaac Hartstone's destruction by chainsaw a secret.
Hartstone, he used to live on the stone, but the government just didn't want to leave him alone. Now he's
just such a crazy story, and I didn't know how to cope with it. So what we did was that me and two of my friends, we made a reggae song that's called Isaac Hartstone Killed by the Government.
Now he's evicted from home, stripped to the bone, but nobody likes. Just leave him alone. He used to live on the stone.
Eventually, a troll task force found a new location for Isaac Hartstone and brought Dambo back to rebuild.
He has many, many, many infinite ideas in his head all the time.
Artist Mark Rivera first met Dambo in Puerto Rico. Dambo was building a troll in a parking lot across the street from Rivera's home. Now Rivera's part of his crew. He says another one of Dambo's ideas is to involve the community where he makes his art. In 2014, Dambo made Hector the Protector on the island of Culebra. He sat on the water's edge with a rock in his hand.
And he's just grabbing a rock and throwing it at whoever wants to, invade the island.
But Hector didn't survive Hurricane Maria.
Things in Culebra were really, really, really bad after the hurricane.
Dambo launched a GoFundMe campaign to return to Culebra and rebuild Hector in the same spot. And he invited the island's community to help out.
Local fishermen that helped us out with scavenging wood. There was a school. And you had the children come and they made a necklace for the troll.
The new Hector holds a lantern with a solar panel so boats can see the coastline during a storm.
It's kind of became an icon to the island now. And, a lot of people love him for that.
Back at the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, Dambo hopes these trolls are attractive enough to get people away from their screens and out of their house.
I like to use my sculptures as a mechanism to show people wild nature, because why would people care about protecting nature if they are not connected to it and not reminded that it's there?
In Thomas Dambo's fairy tales, giant trolls are the heroes protecting the planet, and humans are the little people. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
He used to live on the stone, but the government just didn't want to leave him alone. Now he's evicted from home.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Daniel Estrin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Alex Crowe, and that'll do it for this Labor Day edition here of Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you're with us, and hopefully you're able to find some time to have fun today, no matter what it is that you're doing out there. It's 1 minute before 9 o'clock. We've got news on the way.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, a family and employee-owned company dedicated to providing construction, technical, and real estate solutions in a variety of markets nationwide. Featured projects and more at bolt.com.
Support comes from Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, offering personalized tutoring from certified teachers that's designed to inspire. Convenient scheduling and affordable hourly rates. Explore the options, search Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, or call 262-694-6286. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.